Pray that we would understand this book by your Spirit and apply it to our lives. We ask in Christ's name. Amen. We're going to be finishing the study of the book of Daniel tonight as we look at the final two chapters. And so I'm going to kind of walk you through chapter 11 a lot faster than I would like to do, but you'll probably thank me for doing that because it's a very complex chapter involving over 135 specific prophecies that were fulfilled. It is, in fact, a very, very detailed prophecy that has been fulfilled from the time of Daniel up to the time of the Maccabean revolt under a king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, who desecrated the temple in about 165 B.C. Now, it turns out, though, that it wasn't long. In fact, it was the 3rd century A.D. when Porphyry, who was a philosopher, he was one of the first to take the position that the book of Daniel was a historical fiction written by somebody in Judea around 165 B.C. to explain the kinds of resistance that the Jew, or to encourage resistance to the Jews against Antiochus Epiphanes, and that it was actually a pious forgery written in order to convince the Jews that we need to, in fact, fight. We had to have a perspective. And so this has become a pretty standard view of the book. Up to the present time, you will find that that's the majority view. The majority view would be that the book of Daniel was not a 6th century B.C. document at all, but rather it was a 2nd century B.C. Document, and that it was a document that was designed to be a polemic, that is to say, an argument for the Jews to give them a perspective of what was going on in their present time. The primary reason for this was not internal evidence. It was not stylistic evidence or anything, but rather the primary reason for this argument is the assumption that predictive prophecy with this degree of accuracy is impossible. That's basically the reason. It's just too darn detailed. That was the problem. There's no way that these things could have been actually predicted. You see the issue? And it seems to be that this anti-supernatural bias seems to continue to prevail today, and it would be a rare seminary today that didn't buy that view. I'm just telling you that. I have tried to consider both sides of the argument and weighed the arguments carefully, and I'm familiar with the arguments for this view. They're usually based on linguistic and grammatical arguments, especially vocabulary, claiming that the vocabulary of Daniel is late, that the Aramaic is late, that it has historical inaccuracies, and so forth and so on. All those arguments were pretty clearly, in my mind, reviewed and refuted decades ago, but they continue to be taught. And I won't go into the details and belabor it, but as I think I mentioned in the very first study when we were looking at Daniel at the introduction, that Daniel turns out to be actually written in what's called Imperial Aramaic, not a late form, a form of Aramaic that was used actually in the 6th century B.C. That, in fact, the so-called inaccuracies that were mentioned, including Belshazzar and so forth as a king, have all actually been turned around, and it turns out, as I've mentioned before, that Belshazzar really did reign. In 1956, the stele was found with his inscription, and again and again we discover that the kinds of arguments that were used to support this view have been refuted. Nevertheless, it continues to be taught. I mentioned as well, when we were looking at this, that another argument was that there were some late loan words from the Greek. But it turns out that these Greek words are of musical instruments, and that the Greek empire was around well before the time of Daniel, and that these kinds of instruments would have been known and circulated and used. And so it's even there, those arguments aren't strong. When you really press it hard enough, you discover that the main argument is an anti-supernatural bias, for best as I can tell. And I don't find that to be impressive. But anyway, that's where things are, just so you understand that I'm holding a minority view. But I've been pretty convinced all along, even in the sciences, that truth was never determined by a majority vote anyway, so I don't have any problem with that. That never impresses me, the majority view. Yes?
What is the Jewish view of that?
I think they're split on that. The more the conservative and the Reform Jews would probably take the more liberal view, and probably the Orthodox would hold to the traditional view. So it sort of depends even there. You see, liberal Judaism and liberal Protestantism and liberal Catholicism, they're not that far apart. The more liberal they go in terms of moving away from a fidelity to the text, the more they agree with each other, because they pretty much believe less and less. And so it's natural. There's one good way to have an ecumenical union, and that is to say, let's believe practically nothing. And so you can bring things down to a lowest common denominator, you see. And you can do that, but you can have unity at the cost of truth. And there's your problem, you see. And those kinds of movements don't impress me at all. The idea here is that truth, and especially in our century, in our time, in a postmodern era, it's really come under attack anyway, as you know. And the idea of objective truth has been really something that's been spurned and brought under tremendous attack and criticism. But be that as it may, I just want you to understand I'm taking the minority view on this. Verses 1 to 35, as I read this text, portray Israel's history in the 69 weeks that are mentioned in Daniel chapter 9. And the Antichrist, I believe, is not appearing until the last days in verse 36 to 45. So as I see it, as I break it down, there's a sharp break that occurs, and I'll explain why this I take it to be, in verses 35 to 36, and that Antiochus Epiphanes actually becomes a type of the Antichrist. He foreshadows him insofar as the very kinds of things he actually did historically anticipate the kinds of things that Scripture predicts that the beast or the man of sin, the Antichrist, the prince who will come, all those terms are used of him, will actually do in the future. So Antichrist foreshadowed and then manifested, and there would be a gap between them. The little horn, the Antichrist is also compared to being the little horn in the earlier in the book of Daniel. So be that as it may, I just wanted to let you know that there's a sharp break between verses 35 and 36. So what I thought would be helpful for us to do is just walk through these first 35 verses briefly, without much detail, okay, because we could spend lots of time on them otherwise. Because it's my intention not only to do this, but also then to move through chapter 12, so we have our work cut out. But this is supposed to be a guided tour. Remember this. So we're not. This is not a verse-by-verse exposition. I sometimes forget this. Verses 1 to 2 are prophecies concerning Persia. So in verses 1 to 2, we begin with the Persian Empire. Remember, that's the second of the empires, because the first of the empires was, remember, the Babylonian, the Babylonians followed by the Medo-Persians. So the Persian Empire is in mind here. The first year of Darius the Mede, I rode to be an encouragement. And he says, in a protection, I'll tell you the truth, behold, three more kings are going to arise, he describes. And these are in the Persian Empire. So he's describing future kings in the Persian Empire who would arise. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them, and then as soon as he becomes strong, he'll arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. I take it that he's referring here, some of the kings, the primary kings would be Cyrus, followed by Cambyses, then Darius, then Ahasuerus, known as Xerxes. Ahasuerus, do you know who he is? Where does he appear? He appears in the book of Esther. There he's known as Ahasuerus, but his Greek name is Xerxes. And he was this king who invaded Greece, and he gathered a huge army. And in fact, he was successful. Xerxes destroyed Athens. However, his armies were later defeated. And then he comes back to Persia, you see. And so I take it that was fulfilled in that period of time. Yes.
And how does this all relate to what we saw in chapter
8? In chapter 8, if you go back to chapter 8, what you're seeing there is the vision of the ram and the goat. And you recall in the vision of the ram and the goat that the ram represented the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, so and then we jump ahead to the goat, who represents the kingdom of Greece, verse 21 in chapter 8. Okay, so what we're doing here, Bill, is we're kind of going back and we're looking at it again, but we're going to be expanding the history after chapter 8, because the focal point of chapter 8 is Persia followed by Greece. But then after that, he jumps ahead a little bit, and he moves into the latter part of chapter 8 is that little horn. And the little horn will be developed in chapter 11 when we talk about Antiochus Epiphanes. So in chapter 8, you have Persia, followed by Alexander and the breakup of his empire into four and so forth. But then suddenly in chapter 8, he jumps ahead and talks about this other one who will come, this little horn that I take it is going to be seen again in chapter 11. So that's why the interesting thing in predictive prophecy in the Old Testament is suddenly time can be expended between one verse and the next, and you need to look at the context and compare to see where we're jumping. But the description in chapter 8, beginning, I'd say, in verse 23 and following, deals much more with that figure who appears in chapter 11, and I'll give you the verses there, than anyone else, so it makes sense. So the little horn of chapter 8 will be this figure that we're going to see in a moment in chapter 11. Does that help? And I'll give you the verses for that. So then we jump to verses 3 and 4. So if 1 and 2 dealt with Persia, verses 3 through 4, we now move to Greece. And so we see we're moving at a much faster rate. And Alexander the Great, of course, is seen here. A mighty king will arise, he'll rule with great authority, do as he pleases. As soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out to the four points of the compass. Remember we talked about how Alexander's kingdom would be broken up among his four generals, and then it would be dispersed and lose its full power. And this is what occurred. Remember his dates, 356 to 323, a young man when he died. He'd accomplished more in those few years than anyone else in human history in the sense of conquest and the spread of empire. The man had a charisma that was extraordinary. People would do virtually anything. Remember, he led his armies all the way from Greece to Persia, Egypt, Judea, but all the way to India. It's an amazing kind of a thing. And then the man dies of swamp fever at the age of 32. But we have him portrayed there. And then verses 5 to 35, these verses then are prophecies concerning Egypt and Syria. Now, it turns out that two of Alexander's commanders to the south and also into the north, Egypt, the king of the south, the kings of the south, Syria, the kings of the north, became predominant at that time. The other two are not going to be the focal point. And the reason for it, in part, is because Egypt and Syria, what's in between them? Yes, the whole area of Israel. And so Israel, remember, is going to be a political football between the Seleucids, they're called from the Syrian area, they're known as the Seleucid, the family of the Seleucids. So they have Seleucus the First and so forth, and the Ptolemies of Egypt. And you're going to have this problem, and sometimes the Seleucids are in power, sometimes the Ptolemies, and back and forth. And these verses will sort of depict that struggle over the next several centuries. So are we clear here where we're going? So having said that then, verses 5 to 20, now I'm going to go back now and say verses 5 to 20 instead of 5 to 35. Verses 5 to 20 give us the backdrop for Antiochus Epiphanes, who came around in 175 BC. So in verses 5 to 6, that's the backdrop. So 5 to 6, we're going to be looking here in the years 323 BC to the year 246 BC. It was in 323 that who died? Alexander. Ptolemy the First, P-T-O-L-M-Y, Ptolemy the First of Egypt. And Seleucus, S-E-L, I always forget this, E-U-C-U-S, the First of Syria. Okay, so we have Egypt, we have Syria, and these are the two kings that we're seeing in these verses, in verses 5 to 6. The king of the south, that's Ptolemy the First. The king of the north, that's going to be Seleucus the First. We know the period we're dealing with. Okay, are you tracking so far? In 252, Ptolemy, he's also known as Philadelphus, great name, the second, he arranged a diplomatic marriage and gave his daughter Bernice in marriage to Antiochus. There's a whole complicated thing of what took place here, and I'm not going to go into it. But if I go into this, I will be out of time. So I'm just going to have to take it by faith. It's dealing with these people here. Then we're going to jump ahead, verses 7 to 9 here for a moment, and we're going to pick up from verses 240, the period of 246 to 240. The dates 246 to 240. Now we're dealing with Ptolemy the second, who murdered, he was the brother of the murdered Bernice, and he became ruler of Egypt and invaded Syria. So he just describes this. One of the descendants of her line will arise in his place. He will come against their army, enter the fortresses of the king of the north. He will invade Syria. And he will deal with them and display great wealth. And what happened is he returned with great booty. According to Jerome, 40,000 talents of silver, 2,500 images of gods previously taken out of Egypt by Persia, to Persia by Cambyses. But anyway, what you have here is the statement here. He will deal with them, display great strength. Also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, he'll take into captivity. We know when this took place. We have a record of what he took and so forth. It follows line for line with recorded history. Now we're moving right along to verses 10 through 19. 10 through 19, we jump down to the years 223 to 187. We're making a jump here. These verses give details about a fellow named Antiochus III, who was also known as the Great, from the north, Syria, and his struggle with the kings of Egypt. At first, he was very successful, and he gained control of Palestine and of Egypt, but he was later decisively defeated on the southern Palestinian border by a fellow named Ptolemy IV. So we're kind of tracing this through. That's described pretty in pretty much the detail in verses 10 through 19. It goes into more detail than that, diplomatic marriages that took place and so forth. Let me give you an example of that. The king of the north will again, let me see. Let me jump ahead here. Let's see here. Yes, look at verse 17. I'll just give you one example of this kind of detail. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom. And it says that he will bring with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. And what took place here was that there was a diplomatic marriage that was arranged between the two warring nations. This happened a lot, as you well know. And they'd kind of throw out their kids as sops. It was a great way to raise children. You know, they'd use them as political pawns. And Antiochus gave his 11-year-old daughter Cleopatra to be. This isn't the later Cleopatra. There are several Cleopatras. And he gave his daughter Cleopatra to be the wife of Ptolemy V in the year 192 BC. And apparently Antiochus figured his daughter would actually deliver Egypt into his control, but instead she remained loyal to her husband. That's why it says here that. In verse 17, give him the daughter of women to ruin it. You see the idea here? But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. You see where we're going here? That's the kind of thing that we could track together, but we're not. So let's move along. In other words, I'm just giving you an example of how you could lock into it, and we'd take a lot of time to go verse by portion, bit by bit, and compare it with the known history of the time. Yes. That's supposed to be a line there. I don't know where that line came from, though. I don't know. 1871, to 187, and then I had a little line. That's my little line. You see that? 187. That's my little line. You can't tell? I can't understand. Even I couldn't figure it out. Verse 20, that's a long time. Now something's dropped. Just a moment here. Falling apart. Okay, let's see. This is still working. Verse 20 covers the period from 187 to 176, and I won't put a line following it. Or if I did, I'll put a big line like that. How's that? And it says there in verse 20, then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he'll be shattered. though neither in anger nor in battle, and this is referring to a fellow named Seleucus the Fourth, who inherited the kingdom, but he had a great debt to Rome, he had to pay a lot of money, and then suddenly the guy disappeared. He just died very mysteriously, probably poisoned by the treasurer of his kingdom, so he didn't last long. Now we start hitting the big one. Beginning in verse 21, you can trace it back to chapter 8, beginning with the description of the little horn there, and it's the same person. So we're looking at verses 21 to 35. We are now dealing with the main man, Antiochus the Fourth. And Antiochus the Fourth of Syria was, in fact, the figure who, from 175 B.C. to 164, was the little horn of chapter 8 and was a despicable person whose treatment of the Jewish people and their religion in that intertestamental period really was a foreshadowing of similar happenings that will happen during the tribulation under Antichrist. That's the picture we're invited to see, that we're dealing with a historical precedent that anticipates, in a typological way, a worse thing that's going to follow. Having said that, then, he's described in this way. In his place, in the place of the one we just mentioned, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he'll come in the time of tranquility and seize his kingdom by intrigue. Turns out to his rise to power, he seized the throne, though it was not rightfully his, and he enjoyed some early military successes. Then he deposed Ananias II, who was the Jewish high priest, and stuck in a person who was not a Levite and stuck him in that line. And he began to establish his own priesthood and impose his own religion on the Jews. He formed and broke leagues and extended his power throughout Syria, Palestine, and so forth, and used bribery to gain support of the people, according to verse 24 and according to history. Verse 25 through 28 describe his invasion and his victory over Egypt, and he'll stir up his strength and so forth, go to the king of the south. And he'd have a firm base at home, and he defeated a later Ptolemy in the year 170 in the border of Egypt, and he began to strengthen himself. And what happened is he worked out truce arrangements, but they practiced treachery. Of course, this never happens today. Verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They'll speak lies to each other at the same table. Does that ever happen? So this is the problem. It's too characteristic of peace conferences that we've discovered in the years to follow, of course, both ancient and modern. And he puts down a small insurrection in Jerusalem on the way back and takes opportunity to plunder the temple. Look in verse 28. He returned to his land with much plunder. His heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action and then return to his own land. You with me here? So he starts, but it's going to get worse because 29 and 30 will describe another invasion. This time he invades Egypt without success. And this took place in the year 168 B.C., and he wasn't successful because he was met by the Romans this time, near Alexandria. And the Romans weren't keen on what was happening, and a fellow named Scopas handed him a letter from the Roman Senate ordering him not to fight against Egypt. Now, I won't go into detail, but he'd actually spent as a youth some 12 years under the Romans before, and he knew that they were not bargainers. And when he hesitated about this business because he really desperately wanted to defeat the Egyptians and didn't want to follow the Romans' order, he hesitated. You know what the Roman consul did? He drew a circle around Antiochus on the sand. And he told Antiochus, you must make a decision before stepping out of the circle. That's how it was. And he remembered the power of his Rome from his 12 years of living there. And humiliated, frustrated, and enraged, he turned back to Syria with empty hands. He traveled a long distance to Egypt for nothing. He's bummed out, and where is he going through to get to his own land? Where is he going to take out his vengeance, his enrage? You see, it's exactly what's going to happen. So let's read the verses 29 and 30. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this time it will not turn out the way it did before. But for ships of Kittim will come against him, and these were the Romans and the emissaries and so forth, and therefore he will be disheartened, and he will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action, so he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Forces from him, it says in verse 31, will arise. And this is described then in these verses, that his persecution of the Jews, particularly 168 to 165 are the key years of pain and persecution for the Jews. This is what would lead to the Maccabean revolt. And we have good detail. You can compare this, what happens in these verses, verses 30 to 35, with chapter 8, verses 10 to 14. So if you want a comparison, compare 30 to 35 here with chapter 8, 10 to 14. And again, Antiochus stops in Palestine, but he vents his frustration and anger against the Jews, and he connives with apostate Jews and stops the daily sacrifices from occurring at the temple, and he desecrates the sanctuary by erasing, in the place of the brazen altar, a statue of the Greek god Zeus. And this was the abomination that made the temple desolate. Why was it desolate? Because, of course, no faithful Jew would think of approaching such an idol to worship Yahweh. So the temple was desecrated and made desolate. Let's read the verses. So it describes how there will be, with smooth words, he'll turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant, and so forth. We saw that already. And then those who have insight, though, among the people will give understanding to the many. And this is referring to the rising of the Maccabean revolt here. Inspired by the Maccabees, Mattathias and his five sons, among whom was Judas Maccabeus, would rise up. But thousands of Jews were slaughtered during this period of time. And when they fall, they will be granted a little help. Many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure. Did you catch that? I want you to understand something. He mentions the persecution has a purification effect, that the persecution of the Jews actually refines, purges, and makes them pure till the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Verse 36, then the king does what he will do as he pleases. All of a sudden, I'm going to say that there's a change here. I'm going to say that that abomination, you notice the verse 31, I forgot to read that to you, they will set up the abomination of desolation. You see that there? That abomination of desolation is an anticipation of what Jesus refers to. If you jump ahead in Matthew chapter 24 for a moment to the Olivet Discourse and hold your finger here, verse 15. You with me in Matthew 24, 15? Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, that's the verse we just looked at here, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. And there are two aspects of a fulfillment here. One would take place in the year 70, but the one he's referring to is one that refers to a great tribulation that occurs right after that. Take a look in verse 21. There will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. And he's talking then about what I take to be the tribulation that would be a yet future event. So there's an analogy here. Let me explain, though, why I believe verses 36 through 45 of chapter 11 do not deal with the same one we were looking at up to 165 B.C. and go into some detail. This is the climax of the chapter. So I'm going to say that the suffering of the Jews under Antiochus during these years was a foreshadowing of the deeper afflictions under Antichrist. Let me give you several reasons. Number one, the scope of the prophecy we're about to see includes the latter days. 10:14. Remember, chapter 10 set the backdrop. This is all part of one vision. Daniel's fourth vision, chapters 10 through 12, one vision. And verse 14, I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. And he's talking about events that would occur in the latter days. And also, I would say, while the prophecies through verse 35 find fulfillment in history, the prophecies in verses 36 and following do not find fulfillment in history. In fact, there's no actual historical correspondence with these verses, but there sure is with all the others. You see, where all of a sudden we move away from fulfillment. Also, I might say that this king is actually distinguished from the king of the north. Whereas up to verse 35, it was the king of the north. You see where I'm going? The king of the north was. Look at verse 40. At that time, in the end time, the king of the north, south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and so forth. So clearly, this person now we're talking about isn't the king of the south or the king of the north. It's yet another figure. I would also say that these verses correspond beautifully with other passages concerning the Antichrist. Let me give them to you in case you're interested. Chapter 7, verses 24 to 27 of Daniel. 7, 24 to 27. 8, 23 to 25. 9, 26 to 27. And let me give you a couple for the New Testament that we've looked at before. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4 and following. And also Revelation chapter 13 and chapter 17. In fact, it would be a very interesting exercise to read all those together, and you'd see a coherence and a consistency. I would also say the time of great tribulation will occur in connection with this person's rule, because we see in chapter 12, verse 1, that that's in fact going to happen. Look at this statement here in chapter 12, 1. At that time, we're still at the same time, same period. Remember, there's no such thing as chapters in the Hebrew. You understand this. At that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. Does that sound similar to what Jesus described in what we just read? And he says, and at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. So he's talking about the very end times here. And those are some reasons or others, but he's going to act in self-will, verse 36, and he's going to exalt himself. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak monstrous things against the God of gods. He'll prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. And this, I think, compares very well his blasphemy against the one true God in Revelation chapter 13, verse 6, and also in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. I refer that for you to read. He'll reject all deities, verse 37. And in verse 38 and 39, he's going to place confidence only in power. The only God he's going to honor is that of power. He'll reward those who serve him with allotments of land, according to 38 and 39. Then in verses 40 to 43, he's going to make a covenant to guarantee Israel's borders. But there's going to be an alliance of Egypt with her allies and the kings of the north. If I compare this, by the way, with the book of Ezekiel, verses 38, chapter 38 and 39, it seems to me, as I can see it, that the kings of the uttermost north, my own view, and you can take it or leave it, is that there's the kings there are referred to are the Russians with an alliance with Egypt, and that there will be a problem that will produce against his protective treaty, apparently during the middle of the 70th week. And the weapons that appear here possibly are best understood in terms of their modern counterparts, though it's possible that societal upheavals in that day will have caused a reversion to simpler weapons. But he describes weapons there in verses 40, chapter 40 and following. He'll enter the beautiful land of verse 41, which is Israel. Stretch out his hand against other countries. The land of Egypt will not escape, and so forth. Take control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and so forth. But then he goes on to say, verse 44, near the end of the tribulation, he's going to face renewed conflict. Where do these rumors come from? Rumors from the East. Compare this with materials that we find in other parts of Scripture. And I take it that there are armies from the East that are described in Revelation that he's going to hear about. And this will be a renewed conflict from the East as well as from the North. Let me give you verses for that. Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 to 21. So compare Daniel 11:44. With Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 to 21, and Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. I'll let you look that up. Sort of described in Revelation that he's going to hear about, and this will be a renewed conflict from the east as well as from the north. Let me give you verses for that. Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 to 21. So compare Daniel 11:44 with Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 to 21, and Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. I'll let you look that up yourself, and you'll see a connection between those two. Having broken his covenant with the Jews, he's going to become their persecutor. So the first 3.5 years, time, times, and half a time. A year, 2 years, and a half a year. As we see throughout Scripture, in this text, and also in Revelation, it refers to 3.5 years, 42 months, or also 1,260 days, but it's the same period. In any case, during that time, the first half of the tribulation, he has established a covenant of peace with the Jews. And that's when it begins, Daniel's 70th week. Remember what it says here, verse 27, this prince who will come will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of that week, Daniel 9:27 says he'll put a stop to their sacrifice and grain offering. On the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. See the abomination of desolation there as well. And so I take it what will happen then is actually he comes and presents himself like a Messiah who offers peace, establishes a treaty that will solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, apparently for good. But after 3.5 years, he breaks covenant, sets himself up now to be worshipped himself as God, and begins to persecute the Jews. And the latter 3.5 years, are what are called the Great Tribulation, and literally all hell breaks loose. And in Revelation chapter 6 through 19 describe that process. Having said that, he's going to become then their persecutor, and he'll make Jerusalem his headquarters. And so it says he'll pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas. What are the seas he's describing there between the Mediterranean Sea then and the Dead Sea there? And he's going to be right there in Jerusalem. And it says between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. What's the beautiful holy mountain? That's Zion. And so he's going to be there. And he's going to meet his end, though, with the armies of the earth who gather at Armageddon, according to Zechariah chapter 14, verses 1 to 4, Revelation chapter 19, verses 19 to 21. Well, I've worn you out on that one. I told you it was not going to be easy. Questions? Yes.
You were telling us that I forgot the translation of the Hyacinth. Is there any parallel with that?
Yeah. The Antichrist, the only names that are given for him are the beast, Revelation, the man of sin or lawlessness, 2 Thessalonians 2, the prince who will come, Daniel chapter 8, and also the little horn, Daniel 8, the prince who will come, Daniel 9 and Daniel 11. An antichristoi, John uses that particular term. He says, behold now, he says that Antichrist is coming, but many antichristoi, plural, will arise and have already arisen. And he describes how they are symbols or anticipators of that Antichrist. So an Antichrist, the symbolism there, of course, is that he sets himself up as a counterfeit of Christ and wants people to have the illusion that he's the Prince of Peace. That's why he comes with the appearance of being a peacemaker in a time of great conflict and a desperate need, a growing need, I take it, in the area of where the Roman Empire originally was, namely the whole European theater, that there would be a desperate need for somebody to unite them and to give them peace and security, not unlike what Hitler was promising to the Germans when he rose to power, because they were desperate. They were willing to substitute their freedom for security and for the illusion then of provision and protection. So it will also happen here in a time of No, there's a connection, but really, Epiphanes, the great one, you know, so he was just seeing it, yeah, this is a little bit different there. There was just, no, not a connection. I wouldn't make that, yeah.
Where do you think he comes from? Does he come from Rome?
Which one, the Antichrist? He's a Gentile, not a Jew. The false prophet, evidently, though, is Jewish. There's some evidence to suppose that. But the Antichrist is from Rome, the revived Roman Empire. It doesn't specify where he comes from, whether he comes from Italy, whether he comes from Germany, whether he comes from some area like that. We do not know. So, in fact, I can tell you this: if I read Scripture right, you won't know who he is until the rapture occurs. You will not know. And so any guesses that you make, and there have been many guesses, you know, it's for a long time, everyone thought, a lot of people are saying it's going to be John F. Kennedy, you know, because after all, it says the Antichrist will recover from a mortal wound. Got to be him. And they're keeping him alive in some hospital room. You know, those kinds of, sounds like the Elvis rumors, you know. Maybe it's going to be Elvis. But the thing about it is that it's no use speculating. My own belief, if I were pressed, I can't prove this. If I were pressed, I believe he's alive. I believe he's going to be coming into political power, but we won't know him for who he is until the time arises. Because I take it, according to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, that there's reason to see that he is not going to be revealed. And it says specifically there, 2 Thessalonians 2, that the second coming will not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, who opposes and so forth. And so he says, the mystery of lawlessness is at already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of that way, and then the lawless one will come. He's going to oppose himself and exalt himself above every so-called god or object of worship, which is very similar to the description we saw here. But I don't believe he'll be revealed then until that time occurs. So I'm not going to guess who he is. I just think my guess would be he'd probably be European. That's as far as I could guess, but I can't demonstrate that. I'm not saying it has to be that way. But as I see it, then he's probably a Gentile, and he'll come through a political arena, but probably not become dominant until after the church is taken away. At least this is my understanding. That's my view. Yes? Well, it certainly was a Holocaust, no question about it. But there was an earlier Holocaust that almost was pulled off, and that would have been under Haman. Remember in the book of Esther, that was a potential Holocaust. But you could say the first Holocaust, really, of the Jews was not this. The first Holocaust was the destruction of Jerusalem in the Babylonian captivity. That was the first Holocaust. This is a second Holocaust. And then the third Holocaust occurred in 70 A.D., and then there was a fourth Holocaust in 135 with the destruction of Jews. And then there was others along throughout the Middle Ages, and where they were consistently persecuted people, as you well recall. And then finally, the biggest in terms of scale, of course, most recently, was what we call the Holocaust. But that was the biggest of us in a series. And that the people of God, that the Jewish people have been consistently persecuted and marginalized and ghettoized. But ironically, what's happened there, the ghettoization up until, which is a very recent phenomenon where that stopped, if that's not the case, has kept their racial purity, whether they liked it or not. Much of as what happened in Egypt, you recall, when they went down to Egypt, remember they were starting to intermarry with the Canaanites, and God put an end to that when he brought them down to Egypt, because the Egyptians would have nothing to do with the Semites. And so they had no choice. They couldn't intermarry, and they retained a purity. And so there is a growing concern now, though, especially with American Jews, because there's this beginning process of intermarriage. But as more and more go to Israel, that's happening less and less. So I think that what we're seeing, this exodus from all the nations, my prediction is that's going to continue to happen, and more Jews will continue to go back to the Holy Land, and that's where the continued exodus will take place. That will be the place where they'll... So you can predict that that's going to continue to occur. I also predict that you'll always be hearing about Jerusalem, which was a backwater nothing 100 years ago. Nobody would have even heard about it. Who would have thought in 1850, let's suppose, that Jerusalem, this little dump in this arid province here, would now, in 100 years after that, be in frontline news and more frequently as the years would go by. And it's always in the paper. I predict it will stay in the paper for good reasons, but that's another story. Margaret. Antiochus did that. I think he slaughtered a pig, and also it was also Titus of Rome. The Romans also desecrated the altar in 70 A.D. So there were two abominations that occurred, but again, both of them were anticipations of this larger thing that is connected with this time of tribulation. We do, because it describes it in 2 Thessalonians 2, where he sets himself up. This time it's not somebody setting up Zeus as God. This guy sets himself up as God and sets up an image of himself, which the false prophet actually animates somehow and makes him speak bold things, and people worship this image of the beast who now proclaims a worldwide domination. He's only really a dictator of the what I would call, for lack of a better term, the United States of Europe. But then what happens is he becomes a worldwide dictator trying to set up a one-world government for 1,000 years. Does that sound familiar to you? Remember the Third Reich, 1,000 years it was going to be? One-world government. Ultimately, these were the ambitions. These are not surprising things because these are the things that are kind of wired in. But remember, and I want to stress this, do not forget chapter 10 appears before chapter 11. What is that telling you and me? What did we learn in chapter 10? The warfare that we see in this present world is animated by spiritual forces in the heavenly places. So it's not just a mere matter of the earthly theater, but there's actually a spiritual realm behind it. And that's why Michael and other angels are doing warfare with these other principalities and powers, and there is in fact a spiritual conflict behind the earthly conflict. But the stress of Scripture is that God Himself is in control and waits for the proper moment until He brings in the fulfillment of His purposes. So the scene in Scripture is always that of a settled assurance of hope that God Himself will accomplish these things and bring them through this process. It'll be painful, but as it says in Romans chapter 11, let me just read you just one little verse from Romans chapter 11 that describes it this way. He says, I don't want you to be, brethren, speaking to the Gentiles to the body of believers uninformed of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in, and thus all Israel will be saved. And so he describes how there's going to be a partial, not complete, and temporary, not permanent, hardening. And then in the end times, that will begin to be lifted, which I see is happening in our century. More Jews are coming to faith in Messiah, as we've seen, in this century than in all the centuries, it seems, since the first. It's just an extraordinary thing to see. And then he says, and thus all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob. And this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. And so Paul anticipates that time when all the Jews who are remaining at the end of the tribulation will be delivered. In fact, he says, I will not come again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That's when I'm going to come back. When you, my people, call me and ask me to return, that's when I will return. Until that time, you will not see me. Hold your questions and we'll go a little bit further because I want to finish chapter 12. I am going to finish. Fortunately, chapter 12 teaches quickly. But I will just give you a few applications from chapter 11. I will just say this. The accuracy with which these many prophecies have been fulfilled underscores God's sovereignty. Because I take it that they really were predictive. And they call us to expect that the remaining prophecies will be fulfilled in the same way, with that same graphic precision in the future. And I'd also say that there are ironies in history that this chapter reveals. In spite of all of Antiochus' efforts to be a man of power and influence, his every action plays out God's prophetic plan. Don't miss that. Behind the scenes, God uses even the wrath of his enemies to bring him praise. That is a wise thing for us to keep in mind because we'd be wise to cooperate with God in our lives as well. Because when you do that, God will be glorified and you'll be a lot more satisfied than when you resist God. Because who has resisted God without pain? You see the idea? It is not a wise thing. So we will serve some kind of a God. If it's disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, as Joshua said, choose then yourselves today whom you will serve. That you will serve, and if it's not the God of creation, of all creation, it'll be a God in creation, in the created order. You can't avoid service to something. I would also say we don't look for Antichrist. We look for Jesus Christ. There's an important distinction. He's the point of all prophecy, and it's our relationship with Him that really determines our destiny. That's the main thing. And I would also mention something else. There is a purpose of tribulation in our lives, just as there was one here. And the key passage for that is Romans chapter 5. Just let me quickly allude to it. And it's going to be verses 3 through 5 where he says, we exult in our tribulations because we know that they bring about perseverance, proven character, and hope. And I would say that there's no real change in a person's life unless they embrace a biblical perspective. And a biblical perspective, the other side of that coin is always hope. If you see the bigger perspective, there's always hope. My problem is I get things out of proportion and let little teeny things bum me out, and I lose the bigger perspective and fail to contextualize the little hassles of life and fail to see the bigger hope and the bigger perspective. Chapter 12, just a few words about this. He describes two resurrections. I already read verse 1. Verse 2, many of those, it says, who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. As I see it, he's describing the resurrection of tribulation saints, and it's probably the same as the resurrection of Old Testament saints. Revelation chapter 20, verses 4 to 6 indicate that there's not one general revelation of the resurrection of the just and the unjust, but actually the resurrection of the just precedes the resurrection of the unjust by 1,000 years. And that what happens is there's 1,000 years between the two resurrections in Daniel 12, 2, and in John chapter 5, verses 28 to 29, which Jesus describes as well. This is hinted at the word many. Now, it doesn't say all of those who sleep in the dust will awake right there, but many. And here's what Jewish commentators have done. They say, many from among the sleepers of the dust of the earth shall awake. These shall be unto everlasting life. But those of the rest of the sleepers, those who do not wake at this time shall be unto shame and everlasting contempt. They themselves have seen a distinction between two resurrections, even one in time, which is only revealed later in Revelation chapter 20, that there is not one general resurrection, but two facets of resurrection. Resurrection, the first resurrection and the second resurrection, as this described in Revelation 20. I'd leave you there to read that. But look at verse 3. The righteous, those who are righteous in this resurrection of the just, will manifest the glory of God as the heavens now do. In Psalm 19:1, where the heavens declare the glory of God, then we will declare the glory of God. Look at it says, those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Which is a marvelous thing. And of course, star differs from star in glory, as we well know. Romans 15 talks about the resurrection of the body, and some will have a greater illumination than others. As C.S. Lewis says, does this mean we're going to be like big cosmic light bulbs? It's a little bit more profound than that, but it's the glory of God that will be manifesting, and His beauty as well. And that we're destined to reflect the Shekinah glory of God forever. Verse 4 says, as for you, Daniel, though, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. It is not for you. Many will go back and forth, and knowledge will increase is as good a description of our times as I can ever imagine. In fact, Isaac Newton predicted on the basis of this verse right here that the day would come when knowledge would be so increased that people would be able to travel 50 miles an hour. Based on this verse. And Voltaire, in response to Newton's prediction, cast great ridicule, not only in Newton, but also in the Bible. Well, it turns out Voltaire was right. Right? You know, it was held the idea that if a person traveled 50 miles an hour, they'd die. It was just, no one was meant to travel that fast, you see. Well, we've managed to travel 26,000 miles an hour as we go orbiting around the Earth. That's rather quick. But my point is here that Newton was far from the mark. And if we look at the speed of travel, it's gone up exponentially. If we look at the growth of information, it's gone up exponentially. If we look at communication, gone up exponentially. There has been an unparalleled growth in these things in the last 30, 40 years. The world's never seen anything like it. And I think we're real close to the end. Then I, Daniel, verse 5, looked and beheld and saw two others beholding, standing on the bank of the river, one on this bank, one on that bank. One said to the other, to the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? And I suspect, by the way, that we're dealing here with two angels, and the man in linen may be the Lord himself from chapter 10, verses 5 to 6, maybe. In any case, there's a question. Here's what it says. I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river as he raised his right hand and his left toward heaven. and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time. And again, if we looked at and compared, I'll give you some other verses to compare this, to show that it really is 3.5 years. Write them down if you want them. Chapter 7, verse 25 of Daniel. Chapter 9, verse 27. Chapter 12, verses 11 to 12. Also, Revelation 11, 2. Revelation 12, 6. Revelation 12, 14. Revelation 13, 5. If you want them, I'll give them to you later. If you didn't get them all. But if you compare all those, you get the clear, consistent picture that we're dealing with really 3.5 years on 360-day prophetic years, which are always 360-day prophetic years. Daniel then is given a reply. As for me, I heard but couldn't understand. I said, my Lord, what will be the outcome? And Daniel was told, go your way. These words are concealed and sealed until the end time. They're not for you to understand. They will not be fully grasped until the end times. And as I look in human history, I personally believe, now people may disagree with me, but it's my belief that the import of these verses has not been grasped until about the latter part of the 19th century. And only in recent years are we beginning to catch the implications of these things. And only we're beginning to see it fill in more and more. But let me promise you, you know who this book was really written for? People who are living in the tribulation. They're going to know this better than you and I. I promise you. When they read this book, it'll be like a manual. And they'll understand things that you and I can't grasp at that time. So, my belief is we're going to leave a lot of Bibles behind. And it'll be very good for them to use it. These events, verse 9, are far in the future. The hearts of men, it says, will be revealed. Many will be purged, purified, and refined. The wicked will act wickedly. None of the wicked will understand. Those who have insight will understand. From that time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up will be 1,290 days. And so he describes this fact here that there will be a period of time then after the sacrificial system is ceased, the last half of the tribulation. But then he goes on to describe 30 extra days, not 1260, but 1290. And I take it the extra 30 days beyond the second advent may relate to the regathering and judgment of Israel, Ezekiel chapter 20 and Matthew 25, and the gathering and judgment of the nations, because that's why 1290, not 1260. Then he has another 45 days beyond these, and he says, how blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1335 days. No one knows for sure, but it may relate to the time necessary to set up the governmental machinery to carry on the rule of Christ. Don't know this, but you know who will know it? People at that time will not fully understand it. Finally, and this is important, as for you, go your way to the end. Then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. What is Daniel told? He's given a promise that he himself will be resurrected. These are the resurrections as I see them. Stage one, I believe, is at the rapture. The end concludes the church age. Stage two, there's a tribulation period. And at the end of the tribulation, those who were beheaded during the tribulation, as well as Old Testament saints, will rise. First resurrection. Then there will be another resurrection, Revelation 20, 11 to 15, of the wicked. The second resurrection of the unjust. The first resurrection of the just. Those are the distinctions I draw. I predict, by the way, there's got to be another resurrection here. Because what about the millennium saints before the creation of the new heavens and the new earth? So I'm just implying that they too, at the end of that time, because obviously they're not going to survive the destruction of the present heaven and earth, they've got to be resurrected. Having said all that, my last word here is to say, as we compare Daniel, we see it beginning and concluding, and we see some important things. We go from the destinies of the nations, as we saw in chapters 2 through 7, to the destiny of Israel in chapters 8 through 12. And we also see some interesting contrast. Listen to this. Daniel begins with captivity and ends with resurrection. Don't miss the connection there. Make sure my thing's still working here. Yeah. Okay. Secondly, it begins with Nebuchadnezzar ruling and ends with Messiah ruling. See the idea? There's a definite development there. Third, it begins with the times of the Gentiles and it ends with the time of Messiah. Fourth, it begins with Daniel captive and ends with Daniel resurrected. See, so you see some tremendous differences in this book. Just some last thoughts. Verse 3. Gives a challenge for us to be faithful as ambassadors of Christ's life to the lost. There's a great reward since it's near the heart of God, and the purpose for which Christ came is to seek and to save that which is lost, and we are called to the incredible privilege of participating in it. This book that reveals so much about God's plans for the nations of the world ends with the comforting revelation that he's also got a plan for individuals. And that's why we have the reward, which is not here, but awaits us, according to Hebrews 11:13-39. And finally, there's the hope of the resurrection itself, where we know that our labor is not in vain, because we, in fact, are people who have been called to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and because he rose, so we too will rise from the dead. If you need to go, you can leave. I'm going to allow about 3 or 4 minutes of questions before I quit, so I'm running out of time, but any comments or questions as we close this? I do have an announcement to give, and I better give that announcement before we quit. Let me put this on.
In Daniel chapter 8, verse 8 and 9, and I ask you if this is correct, my understanding of this, it says, therefore the male goat, and that's how he's in his grave, right?
Yeah.
You're very great, but when he, we're talking about the goat again, now he's under the grave, came strong, a large horn was broken. That refers to his death.
Yes,
Okay. And in place of it, that is in place of Alexander the Great Horn, was broken. Four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven.
Right.
That, in my understanding, is the four generals that divvied up the land.
That's right.
And then it says, and out of one of them, that is, out of one of those four territories, came a little horn. Isn't that the Antichrist?
No, that's Antiochus Epiphanes.
That's not, it's never referred to as Antichrist?
No. Because the little horn describes himself as being the one who actually magnifies himself to be equal and so forth. However, there are many who believe, though, that both could be typified in that same passage. And my own view is that there could be a double fulfillment. So I take it that it's both Antiochus Epiphanes, but it also alludes in a double fulfillment to the final Antichrist.
Yeah,
so it's a both and. I'm taking it as a both and. Yeah. It gets a little bit more intense. Yeah. Yeah. But I think we have a double fulfillment. It's not one or the other. Let me just close then in prayer, and then, because I can see you're getting antsy. I can always tell. By the way, next week we are going to begin the book of Hebrews, and so next week we're going to do Hebrews in an hour. I always do my overview, and then we do move into it after that, okay? So I'll give you the Hebrews in the big picture next week. Father, we thank you for our time. We thank you for this incredibly faithful man who ministered faithfully and with integrity and dignity for well over 70 years. I pray that he would become a model for our own lives, that we would be people, men and women, who run the race well and finish well, that we don't just finish, but that we finish well. I pray that you would cause us to trust you and hope in you in the course of our life. In Christ's name, amen.